Members, it being 3 o'clock, we'll call the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division. We do have a quorum. With that, Representative Lunan moves the minutes of April 16th. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The minutes are adopted. And with that, members, we have a few that are going to disappear and come back. We're going to start with House File 3127, Representative Detmer.
Mr. Lucas.
Representative Erickson moves House File 3127 for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
members.
Detmer, excuse me.
Good evening. And House File 3127, just to give you a little an introduction here, then I'll turn it over to my testifiers here. But under current law, agriculture preserve status is allowed to expire no earlier than 8 years after the notice has been given by either the landowner or the local authority for planning and zoning. And under the proposal, the agriculture preserve status would expire immediately if the state agency or the governmental unit purchases the property or obtains an easement over the property for purpose of creating and expanding a public trail or park. However, the agriculture preserve status would expire only for that portion of the property that is acquired by the trail or the park for park purposes. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to our mayor of Scandia, Christine Maveski.
Welcome, Madam Mayor. Please state your name and who you're representing for the record.
I am Christine Maveski, mayor of the city of Scandia, which is a small piece of paradise in northeastern Washington County, the farthest reaches, I will say.
Is that paradise covered in snow also?
It certainly is.
Can you bring brochures?
Well, next time I will. Thank you. I'd like to thank you, Vice Chair Ertas and committee members, for hearing us today. And, of course, thanks so much to Representative Detmer for bringing this bill, which we think will mean a great deal for the community and economic development of Scandia, for his bringing it before you and before the Minnesota House for consideration, and we hope for passage. I'm going to turn over to our city administrator, Neil Saltis, who will be giving you background on the bill. So thank you again very much, and then
thank
I'm available
you.
For questions, of course, if you should have them.
The city of Scandia's city administrator.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Neil Saltis. I'm the city administrator for the city of Scandia.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. A little bit of background on the project and what the genesis for the bill. In 2016, the DNR purchased a trail easement of about 0.8 miles for the Gateway Trail over the Arden-Johnson property. This acquisition was the last piece in completing the trail segment that would lead from William O'Brien State Park into downtown Scandia. Mr. Johnson owns about 210 acres, and as the mayor had stated, this is in a metropolitan ag preserve. You know, the trail easement encompasses about 7 of those acres along the western side of the property. In December 2019, Mr. Johnson filed the notice initiating for the expiration of the ag preserve designation, and then based upon statute, as Representative Detmer mentioned, that expiration period must be 8 years from the date of that notice. So consequently, you know, the DNR has issued, you know, the appropriate letter noting that trail development cannot occur before December 28th, 2024. One of the things that, in looking at the Ag Preserve statute, statutes do allow the property to come out of Ag Preserve without any penalty if it's purchased by condemnation. However, when that sale or acquisition is voluntary, we're bound by that expiration provision. And that's really what we're trying to cure. You know, and there are segments where the DNR trying to complete a trail project similar to this may go and through condemnation acquire that easement or acquire that property fee simple. That would allow this designation to disappear immediately. And what we're asking for in this bill is that the same standards apply to a voluntary sale. And one of the keys, at least in this instance, is it really is working to complete the process. You know, this trail segment has been in the, you know, the master plan for William O'Brien State Park since 2007, and that's kind of working up the Scandia from the south. In 2018, the city of Lindstrom has received funding to start extending the Gateway Trail down from Lindstrom down towards Scandia. So we're kind of in the middle, but with this one impediment that could stall the process for, you know, another, you know, 6+ years. So that's really what we're looking for. I think when completed, it really is an exciting project because, you know, the Gateway Trail going to the north in Lindstrom will connect to what is the Immigrant Trail, which connects Taylor's Falls and the St. Croix River over to the Hardwood Trail just north of Forest Lake. So it really is, you know, kind of a key segment in there where currently we're blocked for that remaining 6-year period.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to the testifiers, or maybe to Representative Detmer, this would be across the state. This wouldn't be just for your project, correct? This would be a change in law so that this could occur statewide.
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's just for the seven county metro area.
Yes, okay, yes. So it's that specific, but across that area. Thank you.
And I would have a question for Mr. Hines. Actually, the Ag Preserve Program is primarily in the metro, but there's a couple of rural counties, and so would this not apply to all of the Ag Preserve land?
Mr. Chairman, the Ag Preserve Program in the rural counties is under a different name, so this would not apply to a different statutory section.
Okay.
This would not apply.
Thank you for that clarification. So this really is a circumstance where if you had a hostile taking through condemnation, you could get access to it, but here you have somebody who voluntarily withdrew from the program and you reach a voluntary transaction, and then you're prohibited without fixing this from being able to proceed for 8 more years. Probably too big of an area to build a bridge over, right? All right. Would anybody from the audience like to comment or testify regarding this bill? Seeing none, if you'd like to wrap it up.
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair, while we got the mayor here, she's a farmer.
Oh.
And I'd like to have her share a little bit about her farm. I think the members of the committee would be interested in this. So.
All right.
My family and I own and operate Poplar Hill Dairy Goat Farm, which is Minnesota's supplier of fresh grade A goat milk throughout the state, throughout the 5-state area, actually, through our major distributors. We've been doing this for over 40 years, 45 years, and are very proud of what we have done. We also supply cheese. We have a cheesemaker who makes cheese for us and a soap maker who makes soap for us from our goat milk. We're livestock, proud livestock breeders as well. In 2016, my husband and I were inducted into the Minnesota Livestock Breeders Hall of Fame, the University of Minnesota. Our picture hangs on the wall, and so that's quite an honor for us, and we are the first dairy goat breeders to actually be honored in that way.
Well, that's interesting. Thank you, and congratulations
on
that. I recall last year we had somebody from the Dairy Association, one of the lobbyists, and his wife has the label Redhead Cheese. I think it's out in Bruton, or
yes,
is it Bruton?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and just saw an email. There's something coming up here in the next couple of days, so maybe you're. I don't think they do goat's cheese though. I think they're probably doing.
I don't think
cheese.
So. No.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that, Representative Detmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and also in Scandia. It's a great little town. They have a great time there. I think in September, Taco Days in Scandia. So it's a great time that we have in that community. So, but hope we have your support. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Erickson renews her motion to lay over House File 3127 for possible inclusion. Next, we will go to the top of the agenda, Representative Loeffler, House File 4183. Representative Barr, or Representative Loeffler moves her own bill, 4183, while you're getting ready. Do you have any testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of testifiers. Eric Haugy will not be able to join us this afternoon, but Nan Madden and Paul Eger will be testifying to the bill as well.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
And thank you, members. This bill is another one of those bills that are brought to us or inspired by the federal tax law changes. And Minnesota's property tax refund system is based on federal dependent exemptions that are defined in law referencing the federal law that no longer exist in the federal tax code as a result of the federal tax bill. And if we did nothing, we would find out that the majority of people who qualify for our current property tax refunds would no longer qualify or would get dramatically less because those exemptions no longer exist for children, for being disabled or senior. And so this bill is pretty simple. If you'll notice, it has a fiscal note of zero. And while some of us would prefer to increase the property tax refunds, given that property taxes are increasing throughout the state and are a burden to the people we represent, given all the changes that are going on right now, this bill simply tries to, as best we can, mirror the exact same process that we have right now so that our homeowners and renters, those who are dependent on the property tax system, as we've defined it in law, will not lose anything as we adjust to that. And so what it does is it places in law specific dollar amounts that are equal to what were the federal limitations before and keeps our current measure of inflation going forward, adjusting that as the cost of housing goes up. And with that, I'd be glad to answer questions, and I have, like I said, a couple of testifiers who'd like to share their support.
All right. Members, any questions of Representative Loeffler before we hear any testimony? Seeing none, let's ask the first testifier to come on down. Enter stage right to the Property Tax Committee.
Thank you.
State your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nan Madden, and I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. The Minnesota Budget Project is an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and we identify and promote policies that expand opportunity and economic security in Minnesota.
Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4183. I want to thank Representative Loeffler for bringing it forward, and we're very appreciative that Chair Drazkowski and many other members of this committee have signed on as co-authors of this bill. As you've heard, this is a very simple bill that makes a few changes to our Minnesota statutes to maintain our existing system of property tax refunds. Minnesotans can qualify for a property tax refund if they meet certain income limits and their property taxes are considered high for their income level. And so essentially the property tax refund puts a limit on how much of a family's budget can go towards paying property taxes. This bill simply keeps the status quo. It maintains current rules for eligibility and how property tax refunds are calculated. It simply adds language into our state statute that replaces references to a federal definition that has been changed by the recent federal law, as Representative Loeffler said. Without bringing these definitions into our code, under conformity, Minnesotans could see a total of $84 million in reductions in their property tax refunds that they currently qualify for. And that this provision particularly impacts seniors, people with disabilities, and families with dependents. I think that $84 million cut clearly would be an unintended consequence of the federal tax law that this bill would prevent from happening. Thank you for your time and ask for your support for this bill.
Thank you. Questions from members? Seeing none, thank you. And next on deck is Mr. Egger. Welcome back to the Property Tax Committee. If you'd state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Egger. I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. I'd like to thank Representative Loeffler and all the co-authors of the bill, which I think is about half this committee, for bringing this bill forward. I won't repeat Representative Loeffler's overview of the bill, which covered the details, or Ms. Madden's testimony. I guess I would just add, you know, we feel that this is a very important program that provides direct property tax relief to Minnesota taxpayers. And I went back and I looked at the Minnesota Department of Revenue's 2017 Minnesota Tax Incident Study. I'll just read you one piece out of that. It says, quote, the property tax refunds offset 12.4% of the residential property tax burden, and the refunds offset a much higher portion in the lowest five deciles. This is an important program. We hope that you'll prioritize this issue as part of the federal conformity discussion, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Egger. Questions from members? With that, Representative Loeffler, I notice here the effective date is December 31st, 2017, so that's pay 18 for taxes. And rent paid after December 31st, 2016. Is there a reason for that?
Mr. Chair and members, our property tax system always has, you know, this sort of lag. And rent paid is based on the previous calendar year, but our numbers are a little different for property tax paid. But I would defer to our staff to clarify that if it needs further clarification or adjustment.
Thank you. I guess I understand that as well. I was just thinking that rent paid after December 31st would be paid in 17 and taxes payable. So, Mr. Hines or Mr. Clement, do you have a comment on the effective date for rent versus taxes paid?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Michelle.
Mr. Chair and members, if you recall, the renter's credit, renter PTR, is actually for the filing is in 2018 for rent paid in 2017, and the actual payment goes out in the following year. So it would be a fiscal year 19 payment for that which was filed in 18. So it is correct.
Okay. So they do line up. Representative Loeffler, I had a constituent that wrote me that their daughter, who had graduated from college, came back home and had used her parents' address as her mailing address. And when the parents filed for their property tax refund, the new graduate who had a job with that address came into play with the Department of Revenue and did not qualify them for the renter's credit because the dependent child was household income, but the dependent child didn't have any interest in the property. So he wasn't too happy about that. So anyway, go ahead and wrap up your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The goal of this is, as I said, is just to make sure that we do no harm in adjusting to the changes that the federal government has enacted, where otherwise we would have $84 million less of property tax relief going out to the people that we represent and who are budgeting and accounting on that. And as they've just in the last few weeks gotten those new property tax statements, which in my area are higher again, they really appreciate having us have this income-related relief available to them. And if there's any adjustments we need to make, we'll be glad to do that with the final bill, but appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And Representative Loeffler renews her motion to lay over House File 4183 for possible inclusion. Next, we will take up House File 3526, Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson moves his bill, House File 3526, to be laid over for possible inclusion. The Agricultural Homestead Classification Requirements for Business Entities amended.
Mr.
Thanks, Rep. Anderson. Why don't you give us a preview of what you're up to?
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. And maybe not so much a simple bill, but we're delving into something that I think our assessors will be looking at, and they'll testify too, I'm sure. But getting into the topic of the ag homestead for farmland that's owned by family members, but yet they're, because of legal reasons, they're members of two different LLCs, partnerships, that type of thing. And due to a recent ruling by the Department of Revenue, not a change of statute, but a ruling, county assessors can no longer grant ag homestead if the land is owned by one entity and operated by a second entity, even though they are the same people. And this came about in the last year or two, and it's causing some consternation among farmers out there. I have a letter to pass around in a minute, but it caused one farm operation to see their property taxes go up by $12,000 this year because of that change in classification, not having the ag homestead. I have a couple of very smart folks as witnesses today, Mr. Chair. They will explain the ins and outs of the bill and to answer questions for members of the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And who would like to testify first? Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Caitlin Pals, and I am here representing the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. I'm also an attorney. I practice in New Ulm, Minnesota, and my specialty is estate planning and succession planning for family farms.
And welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And I thank Representative Anderson for bringing this proposed amendment forward. It's something that is very near and dear to my heart because it affects so many of the family farms that I work with on succession planning. So the proposed changes to the statute deal with two provisions of Section 273.124 that deals specifically with agricultural homestead designation. And they deal specifically, again, with agricultural homestead designation for land that is owned by partnerships, LLCs, or corporations that are in turn owned by family members.
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt your testimony for just a moment. It came to our attention, Representative Anderson, you have an amendment for the bill.
I just thought of that myself, Mr. Chair, so thank you for bringing that to my attention. I'd like to move the A1 amendment for the committee's consideration. It makes a couple of changes, word changes, and then gets into what's called a special ag homestead, and I would ask the committee to adopt the A1 amendment.
Discussion to the amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The amendment is adopted. Please proceed.
All right. Agricultural homestead designation is extremely important to family farms, particularly those where there is a plan to transition the farm to the next generation. The obvious impact of agricultural homestead designation is that it does have a significant impact on property taxes. The first $1.9 million worth of value to a farming operations land is taxed at basically 50% of the rate that it would be taxed at if it were non-homestead property. It's also particularly important, again, for farms that are transitioning from one generation to the next because agricultural homestead designation is a prerequisite for qualifying for the qualified farm property deduction from Minnesota estate tax. So that is an up to additional $2.6 million deduction from Minnesota estate tax for homesteaded farmland that the heirs have to be family members and they have to agree not to sell the land outside of the family for a specific term of years. So currently, agricultural homestead is available to land that is owned in a partnership, LLC, or corporation in limited circumstances. It's also available to land that's owned by an individual but operated by a partnership, LLC, or corporation in limited circumstances. The issue is that due to interpretations by Minnesota Department of Revenue, there is no way under these interpretations for land owned by an entity and farmed by an entity to be classified as ag homestead unless those entities are the same entity, regardless of whether there's overlapping ownership and whether everybody who is an owner is a family member. What this proposed amendment would do is fix this issue in that so long as the operating entity otherwise satisfies all of the requirements under current law of having an actively engaged or actively farming member, partner, or shareholder, that entity's owners are also owners of the landowning entity, and both entities satisfy the current restrictions on how many partners, shareholders, or members can be owners of one of these organizations, and also that everyone has to be a family member, that these situations where we have a landowning entity and an operating entity could qualify for agricultural homestead. Now, the reason why this is an important structure to not treat differently the way it is being treated now is because this structure of having an operating entity and a landowning entity is, I think, probably the most popular and the best way to structure farm transitions from one generation to the next. So, for example, mom and dad have three kids, one who's going to come back and farm, two who are not. They want to make sure that they preserve the farming operation for the next generation, but they don't want to write the two non-farming children out of having land ownership completely. So in those situations, the structure that I would recommend is that they would create an operating entity where mom and dad and the child who is going to take over the operation are the sole owners, and then they create a landowning entity where mom and dad and the operator and the non-farming children are owners. While mom and dad are alive, they can create, whether it's a partnership agreement or LLC agreement, that makes sure that the land is protected long-term, that even if one of the kids goes completely overboard and doesn't really want to...
Off the rails.
All right. Yep. Doesn't want to rent to the farming child anymore, that that farming child still has the ability to rent for fair value from the LLC or the partnership, and ensures that there is, however, some benefit to those non-farming children. And that's just not a structure that we can do with leaving land outright to non-farming children. And additionally, there is the issue of liability protection. Even if you have exact ownership, same ownership in both your operating entity and your farm owning entity, we typically don't want those two to be the same entity, because when we set up entities with liability protection, so for example, LLC, the LL is limited liability company, the idea behind that is if something bad happens in relation to that business that's run by the LLC. For example, in a farming operation, there's a terrible accident with machinery. Maybe the insurance coverage doesn't cover all of the damages. With an LLC or other limited liability structure, if that farming operation is sued, the recovery is limited to the assets that are inside of that LLC. The lawsuit cannot recover from the land itself, so the land is protected. And that's a very common structure with almost any kind of particularly professional organization or really many other kinds of business organizations that have high liability potential in the operating piece. So that's all I have to say directly, but I am more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that testimony. Maybe with that, we'll take a break from testifiers. Any questions from members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's a little dangerous because I don't represent any I do represent some urban farms, but they are so small that they would never go through all of this machinations to figure out how to manage their small, tiny urban plot of farming. But it does seem to me that we have to think about what is the whole purpose of homestead, and that is to in an ag homestead, it's to allow the person who is living on that land to continue to have some competitive advantage and to keep the small farms going. But it feels like, compared to all other family-operated businesses, we have made this so complicated. And with so many different degrees of things, I mean, no one in any other business can rent to a cousin or a cousin's spouse and get tax treatment. And now we're talking about if you can create all kinds of different levels of business entities that are all intertwined. And, you know, I kind of feel like we ought to go back to our simple idea of helping the family that's running a small farm. And maybe we should put some, you know, I mean, if you think of cross generation, some of these are century old farms. You could see in 50 years from now, we're going to have some farms that are owned by, you know, 90 or 150 heirs in all kinds of different legal organizations. And it seems to me that our ultimate goal of simplicity is really flummoxed by encouraging people or supporting them to create more and more complexity in the business arrangement. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't be doing generational planning and other things, but that's true of someone who owns the restaurant, the someone who owns a bunch of retail operations, the person who started, you know, the craft brewery somewhere, and now they're down to the third generation or whatever. I mean, it just feels like in this area of law, we've made it fairly complicated for those of us who've tried to understand it, who don't represent those areas. And now we're adding a whole nother layer because we're going to have to learn legal business organizations approaches. And I just have to say that on the record because there's nothing else that we deal with in this committee that is that complicated. And I'm not sure that we need to be that complicated to achieve the goal of having affordable property taxes. And that's the goal, I think, of this committee. Our committee's goal is not to do liability protection. Our committee's responsibility is not to do estate planning or business transfer planning. Our goal is to make property taxes for the current owners and operators manageable, as opposed to worrying about the third or fourth or fifth generation down. It's who's got the land right now, what are they doing with it, and how can we use tax policies to help them keep in operation and contributing to our economy. And I just feel like we've got a bit of mission creep going on here, and I just wanted to say that as someone who, I will admit, knows less about ag property than probably anyone here, but I do think it's asking our committee to step into some mission creep to start changing our tax laws to encourage even more complicated structures.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And I guess I would ask on that point made, Ms. Pels, in the arena that you have decided to exercise your professional experience and practice, you mentioned earlier in your testimony that this was a somewhat of a new rule. Change that, not a statute change, but a rule change as interpreted. Could you maybe reflect on how long you've been doing this and advising clients to do this and when this rule change maybe started to impact your advice?
So I've been practicing for 7 years, almost 7 years, and it's a little simplistic to say that there was one change that completely changed how this works in practice. Minnesota Revenue's position for a few years, and I'm not exactly sure when this became the official word, has been that two entities together cannot make a homestead. However, every county assessor's office has to administer this law. So many county assessors have been looking at ag homestead applications, seeing two entities, and not seeing any problem with granting that agricultural homestead because ownership is matching up. It doesn't look like a problem. Whenever there's a question, however, the assessor's office is going to ask Minnesota Revenue for clarification, and that's where the change has been coming. Whenever any county runs into a situation where they're not sure whether it fits or not, Minnesota Revenue will respond with the page out of the Minnesota Property Tax Administrator's manual that says this position of no, you cannot homestead if you have two entities involved. And after that, that county needs to follow that rule. So there may still even be some counties that are not interpreting homestead in this way, but we have been seeing it becoming more and more common.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, is it my understanding then that the bill as proposed is limited to the LLC being owned by the immediate family owners and not some other ownership of an LLC?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. You know, I could just comment also on Representative Loeffler's comments. I understand and appreciate that you're from a different part of the state than I am, but I have to think back. I think it was a couple of years ago in this committee, we dealt with something dealing with the Ford plant here in St. Paul, extremely complicated, complicated. So I would compare this to that and saying that, you know, if you want to go back to a 40-acre family farm, let's go back to mom-and-pop hardware stores and whatever else. I think those times maybe we'd all have to say have changed, and this is the way agriculture is today, and we have to work with what we have on the scene, and smart business decisions say that these farms today are organized in this fashion, and to say that if the same people own the same property and operate the same property, that they shouldn't qualify for ag homestead, I just have a tough time with that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. We have
Mr. Chair, I just want to respond.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representatives. I would never envision us going back to 40-acre farms, and that was never my intent. My intent was to say maybe this is making it much more complicated, and maybe it really should just focus on what is the tax burden on that size farm, no matter what it is, that is being operated by someone who lives on it, and what's a fair tax burden, and be less involved with the ownership structure. It's about if an owner is living there, but not complicating it with several different legal entities. And I do think that the commercial world has changed, but if you're the owner of a hardware store or whatever, and you become a corporation, you are taxed differently than if you are a subcorp C. And, you know, by making a choice, the business organization, you are changing and accepting the fact that you come under different rules. And this is saying no matter what structure you take, you know, including, and part of what I was reacting to is under 5.17, it says a majority of the shareholders. So it doesn't mean that even all of the shareholders have to be family in the third degree of kindred, which I'm not even sure what that means, but it just says a majority, which that makes it even more complicated in terms of not just keeping it within the family. So I'm trying to understand, but I do feel like this is, maybe I just like a simple, understandable sort of thing. And it's like, if you're this type of business, you do this type of thing on the land that's classified this way, you get taxed a certain way. And if you own a different type of property and use different things with it, you know, then we put you in a different classification. But this one, just the ag statutes in this area are so much more complicated than anything that we deal with in this committee. And it just feels like we're taking another step away from what Representative Whelan and others have been working on and trying to making this a more understandable process.
Thank you for that. We've got two more questions from members, and I will just make the distinction in the comments just made that a hardware store owner, if they're a proprietor or a corporation, that is, the entity is taxed differently, whether it's pass-through or a C-corp. But whether that person owned it as a proprietor, the use of the land would still be CI and would still be taxed at a CI rate, whereas here in the situation of farming, the use is still the same, but the ownership of the entity is different. Representative Barr had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had looked around. I was wondering if there was anyone from the department who could explain why there was this change in interpretation, but I don't think I see anyone here.
I don't think I see anybody from the department here either. Thank you. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Even though I represent the suburb of Shakopee, I actually come from farming. And more specifically, I come from ag banking. And to the comments made earlier, The agricultural businesses are unique in that they are asset-rich and cash-poor. And what compounds that is the fact that the cash flow component of ag is also seasonal. In the outstate area, we're trying to keep people out there. And things we can do to facilitate that we should be doing. But the ag industry is very unique. I listened to my grandfather. I listened to my who was a banker since 1917, my father, who was since 1958, and now my brother, talk about how unique ag lending is and the qualifications, how you determine the asset value and the cash flow challenges that the ag community has. So I understand the need for this bill.
Thank you, Representative. And Representative Marquardt.
So, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, thank you for bringing this forward because I know I've had a few from my area. Does this bill, because it is complicated, does this bill cover this situation for kind of the farmers that would be approaching me? And it is this recent interpretation from the Department of Revenue. Is this bill going, and I will double check with my folks and maybe if it doesn't quite make me, we can adjust it a little bit. But do you think this will take care of what is coming up at this time?
So,
and
unfortunately,
Ms. Pals.
Yeah, sorry. Unfortunately, there have been two recent changes to interpretation. One of them came out, I believe, September of last year. Right. This does not specifically address that. Unfortunately, it's something that would need to go into a different section of the law. I'm certainly happy to talk to anybody about language to fix that piece, but I believe Representative Anderson made the determination that this was as much as we could bite off in one go. So this will solve some ag homestead entity problems, but it does not solve that specific problem that several counties have been sending out letters to farmers saying there's been a change in the interpretation effective as of September 2017, so you'll be losing your homestead for next year.
Okay. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's move on to the next testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Clavin. I represent the Minnesota wheat growers and several other groups today. I just echo everything Ms. Powell said. That would have been my testimony if she had not been here. I would maybe just add from the discussion we've had about the family farm conversation. All farms in Minnesota are family farms. All of them are, with one exception, and that's poultry. And the reason for that is in 1972, the legislature passed an anti-corporate farm law, Chapter 500.24. All farms in Minnesota are family farms. And the reason poultry was accepted back then is because the industry was already integrated by that time. So we don't have Cargill farming against Representative Anderson here. So when you think of that family farm concept, no matter what your structure is, it's all family farms. So size doesn't matter there. You could be 40 acres or 4,000. The 80s, and I'm glad you touched on that, Representative Loon, because that's actually what led to a lot of these structures. In the 80s, the machinery, the livestock, crops, the land, the kitchen sink was all pledged to the bank. And if you ran into one bad year, it all left. Separating this stuff has more of a issue than just the liability part. The structure helps separate some of the assets so you don't lose the entire thing and then you don't have to pledge the entire thing. The other thing this will do is this often is the IRA for mom and dad. And so having mom and dad own the land, rent it to the kids or the partnership with the kids generates passive income for the parents. And the last thing I would probably point about the policy when we talk about this change, wherever this came from, is on your amendment, if I could get you the top of page 5, actually bottom of page 4, starting at 4.25, there's a 5-part test. 40 acres actively farming, Minnesota resident, does not claim another homestead, and then at the top of the page 5, another shareholder does not live farther than 4 townships, which sounds kind of goofy, but I remember when this was done, it was probably, and I don't want to get misquoted on the record, probably around 02, maybe. I remember Senator Westrum was in the House at the time because he had the bill, and the idea was to allow mom and dad to move off the farm to town, and the town could maybe be 20 miles away. So this policy about separating it has been in place for quite some time. It's just the change that has caused the problem for us. The last thing I'd say is in the case of the 12,000, homestead has been granted for a long, long time, and all of a sudden you don't get the homestead, and your tax bill goes up by $12,000. Who gets, where's the money? Is that a windfall to the county? Because certainly they're not going to lower the rates to, for anybody in town, I don't think. Where's the money going? So when you take these away, the county's getting more revenue that they hadn't gotten last year or the year before. Now, someone may have an answer to where that $12,000 went, but that would be a question maybe to discuss. That seems like a windfall.
Thank you, Mr. Clevin. Questions from members? Seeing none, Rep. Anderson, if you'd like to wrap it up.
I just wanted to
quickly
address the question of where the language regarding who is a family member or the amount of family ownership. That language comes directly from Minnesota Statutes 500.24, which is the Minnesota Corporate Farm Law. So reporting over that language into this statute for ease of interpretation, third degree of consanguinity means cousins. Also, I would add that the majority ownership does take into account the fact that spouses would not necessarily be within the third degree of consanguinity.
Thank you for that. Mr. Mays, did you want to make a quick comment? I saw you're over there.
Mr. Chairman, if I could correct one thing. We do have authorized farm corporations where neighbors can get together, but they have to be farmers first. Yeah. So I did want to correct that. We did make that provision in about 99 or so.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Mays. If you would state your name and who you represent again for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I represent the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. And this certainly is a topic that we deal with every year, many times every year. We prepare a position statement for each legislative session. And this year, our legislative position statement, as one of the highlights says, MAO supports consolidating agricultural land and buildings, excluding house, garage, 1 acre, into a single classification rate. Changes to the qualifications for agricultural homestead have added to the complexity of administration of the agricultural homestead classification and confusion on the part of taxpayers. And I might add, it adds confusion on the part of assessors also, because they're the ones that have to administer this. And I never want to pass up an opportunity to show people the chart that the Department of Revenue already publishes to instruct assessors how to determine agricultural homestead. So it is very complex.
Well, that looked like the whole system, and that's just for one classification.
Correct. So we continue to hope that we can simplify ag classification so that everybody is happy with it, but so far that hasn't happened. I'd just like to make those comments.
Questions from members? Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. May, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for your bill. I think the intent of the bill is good. It's a good goal. I have concerns just adding to the complexity, but my question is actually something Representative Barr brought up, and I apologize if this was addressed. I know it would be great to have someone from the department speak to their change in interpretation, but if there was a change in the interpretation, then that would suggest to me that our law was already complex in the sense that it wasn't clear. So is there another way we could do this that would meet the goal but not necessarily add to complexity?
Who would like to take that one? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Whalen. Very good point. And I like your partial line of argument there that this, in fact, may clear up this ambiguity with how this portion has been treated in the past. And we all want to have it done uniformly across the state so that all counties are doing this the same. And as to how or why this change came about, I don't know. I'm surprised Revenue isn't here. Maybe they didn't get the memo about the meeting today, but I think it would at least clear up.
They have someone in the audience. But
I'm here, Paul.
Okay. So that's all I can say about it, too.
Thank you, Rep. Anderson. Representative Whalen, did you have a follow-up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson. I'd be happy to chat more about maybe ways that we can meet the goal but not add to complexity offline. I know Representative Marcourt a few committee meetings ago said we should tackle this simplification next, so I'll just lay that on the table as an encouragement.
Thank you, Representative Whalen. That was a follow-up. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds like we do have someone from the Department of Revenue here. I'm wondering if we could hear from the department.
Department declines. Thank you. Any other questions, members? Was that a wrap-up, Representative Anderson?
I think that means revenue is in favor of the bill. I don't know.
Silence is consent.
No, I appreciate the comments, and it is a complex topic. And when we first talked about this, there were like three layers that we could have gone to address the issue, and I wanted to keep it as simple as we could this time around, and evidently didn't quite get to what we're talking about in Representative Marquardt's situation. But it does look at the situation, and I think we need to make some changes to at least codify how this is treated, and I think this makes that attempt, and I would ask for the committee's support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And with that, Rep. Anderson renews his motion to lay over House File 3526 as amended. Next on the calendar, we will take up House File 3277. Representative Whalen moves House File 3277 for possible inclusion.
Good job.
And Representative Whalen, you have an amendment also. Would you like to offer your amendment to get the bill into its proper form?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would.
Go ahead and introduce your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I appreciate the opportunity to present the bill. The amendment just will be changing the effective date from 2019 to 2020, which will allow the department time to implement a plan for notifying all taxpayers of the changes. The underlying bill is changing some of the dates we have in statute with regard to the property tax calendar. It also will provide a grace period for late applications for the first year. The new dates are in effect as long as the property owner would have met the old dates.
Thank you, Representative Whalen. Any questions on the amendment H3277, the A3 amendment? Questions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I also have an oral amendment, actually. If I could just move an oral amendment to delete lines 8.15 to 8.17, simply because it's just unnecessary language. It's permissive language, and I spoke to some assessors, and they don't feel it's necessary, so I thought we might as well just clean up our statutes.
Could you restate that? You said lines 8.15?
To 8.17.
8.15 to 8.17. Members, question? Mr. Clevenfoot.
Mr. Chair, I think for the oral amendment, all we need to do is just delete the new language on line 8.17. I mean, I think the oral amendment is offered, but Representative Whalen would do the job, but just so the reviser knows what we did.
Okay. So you're recommending just deleting line 8.17.
But so strike the new language on, so page 8, line 17, delete the new language, and unstrike or restore the stricken language.
Could you be more specific?
Mr. Chair, I guess I misunderstood the nature of the oral amendment, so I will defer back to Representative Whalen for that.
Okay, I think members, Representative renews her motion to adopt the oral amendment to delete lines 8.15 through 8.17, Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Clayman. Just to be clear, the language says the county assessor may publish, and then it goes on. They can publish or not publish with or without this language in statute. So just deleting these three lines. It's a very small change, but, again, I think any opportunity to just clean up our statutes is a good thing to do.
Thank you. And Representative Whalen has been leading the charge to clean up the statutes. Any questions on that oral amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of deletion of lines 8.15 through 8.17 from the original text of the bill, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The oral amendment is adopted. Now you have it in your proper form. Please go ahead and discuss your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. As many of you might recall, I had a bill a couple weeks ago that sought to simplify our property tax system that was based on part of the first recommendation in the 2012 Property Tax Working Group report. This bill is based on recommendation number 6 from that report. The list of all 19 recommendations is included in your packet. I worked with MACO and some state assessors to address the technical changes we're making, and I believe this is actually a much simpler bill than my prior one, and mostly we're just changing some dates to make things clearer for the assessors and for taxpayers. We are going from 45 events spread across 28 unique dates down to 18 under this bill, so it's a reduction of about a third. And I'm happy to answer any questions, but I also have Michael Stahlberger here to testify and just walk through a bit more of the bill.
Well, let's hear from your testifier before we take questions. Welcome to the committee, sir, and if you would state your name and who you represent again for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Michael Stahlberger. I'm Director of Taxpayer Services in Blue Earth County. I'm also representing the Minnesota Association of County Officials, MACO.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir.
All right. I appreciate the opportunity to work with Representative Whalen on this bill. It is another attempt to simplify the property tax statutes and the property tax administration system in the state of Minnesota. As Representative Whalen shared, this bill is much simpler than the one that we visited with on several weeks ago, so I won't need to go through as much detail. I am going to highlight, for respect to the time of the bills remaining to be heard this afternoon, the pieces of this legislation that would cause the most impact for our taxpayers, but I'd be happy to answer any questions on any of the specific provisions. The easiest way for us to work through that is to take a look at the summary table that is labeled Representative Whalen handout with today's date on it. And the first thing that we'll do is the oral amendment that was offered today is actually going to strike the item about midway down the table, Section 8, page line 817. The oral amendment actually removed that today for us. The pieces of change that's being proposed today that would have the most impact on our taxpayers are found regarding that homestead application period, so the other items being changed in Section 8. The application for an assessor to receive a mid-year homestead in Minnesota is being proposed to be changed from December 15th to December 31st. And then the last day for the assessor to be able to classify that property as non-homestead is also being changed to December 31st. Those are both recommendations out of the Property Tax Working Group report. And what those will do, that will allow any property that is currently non-homesteaded to receive that mid-year homestead to be eligible for that homestead exclusion and for property tax refund purposes up until the last day of the year for that application to come in. Just provides those owners a little bit of additional time for that, which will be helpful. And it's workable within the assessing community as well for that extension to be acknowledged there. Another change that would be somewhat significant is located in Section 10, line 916, and that is a change to the Class 1B application deadline. Class 1B is our blind and disabled homestead classification. Under current law, that provides some property tax relief to folks that have qualifying blind or disability conditions, reducing their tax capacity and therefore their tax bill. What this bill proposes is changing that date from October 1st to May 1st. Again, that's a recommendation of the Property Tax Working Group. And what that does is it facilitates moving almost all of our special program dates to May 1 in the calendar year, providing some consistency and ease of understanding for taxpayers. Just like we have tax day today for filing our income taxes, we're going to be looking at a May 1 tax day for a lot of our program applications. Another change that's of somewhat significance is Section 13, the tax court filing deadline. If property owners aren't able to work through the normal property tax appeal process, through the local board and county board process, they do have the opportunity to file in tax court. That date is just being moved again to May 1, a very minor change there, but that is something that folks will realize. And then another change that we'll draw your attention to is Section 14, line 13.15. That is our senior citizens deferral application deadline. Qualifying senior citizens who own their property and have been in that property for 15 years under current law are eligible for a deferral of their property taxes above 3% of their income annually. We are proposing under this bill to change that date from July 1, again, to our May 1 program date. Again, that's a recommendation of the Property Tax Working Group. The only other change that I'll draw your attention to on there is back up towards the top of that form. That is for our exempt property owners. That is Section 5, lines 517 and 520, changing again to May 1. So you're hearing kind of a repeating chorus there that we are working on switching over to May 1 for most of the dates in the bill. Almost all of those provisions on that summary sheet and in the bill as it's drafted right now are from that property tax working group. There are a couple of additional ones that Representative Whalen did notice needed to be updated because they were related to provisions of that work group report. But those are minor, again, and in support of the changes that they did recommend. So that's a high-level summary. I would be very happy to hear any questions and try to answer them if I can.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative Loeffler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Stahlberger. I understand the value for administrators to have and for communicating to the public to have a uniform date for some things. But I'm wondering if you could explain May 1st. I mean, we heard this morning in the full tax committee that the governor is recommending and did, again last year, that senior property tax deferral be November 1st because people get oftentimes it's dealing with that October payment that they want to get in. Most homeownership transfers happen between the periods of May to November 1st. I mean, by May 1st, most people have not bought their new home and might be a person with a disability who buys a house in June or July. And so why did you pick May as opposed to later in the year when there's actually been a lot more property transfers over the summer just because that's the Minnesota tradition?
Mr. Chair, Representative,
yes.
I was not part of the Property Tax Working Group when those recommendations were drafted, so I can't speak to why that May 1st date was picked. I do know that is a pretty common date in some of the other property tax statutes, so I think that change was just one that they kind of came around towards as a selection. I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer for why that day was selected from the working group.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank Mr. Chair, and I would respectfully ask you go back to the groups that you're with because I really do think a fall date, given just our weather, the school calendar, tradition, the property transfers tend to happen probably May 1st till, you know, September 1st or something like that. And we wouldn't want to leave people behind in the pursuit of uniformity. And if a fall date like November 1st would work as well, I would appreciate your thinking about that.
Representative Loeffler, as a member of the real estate community, 60% of all home buying decisions are made with children in mind, so that's somewhat consistent with what you claimed about when transactions happen. But Mr. Eggers and I would tell you that we encourage people to consider buying houses all year round.
You're right.
Representative Joaquin, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just actually a question. I'm trying to remember. Most folks don't get their property tax assessment until, is it March? End of March?
Yeah, end of March.
So that is a very, that's very tough for people to make maybe that decision, get all the paperwork in order by May 1st. So kind of to add on to what Representative Loeffler said and Representative Hertaz said, pushing that date out versus rolling it back might be a lot better for folks in making that decision.
Comment, Mr. Stahlberger.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative. That is a valid point, and Representative Loeffler as well. One thing that we do have to keep in mind is that in our property tax calendar, we are assessing in 1 year for taxes payable the following year. So a lot of these dates are actually going to apply for that future year or that following year out there. But it is something that I'd be happy to take back to our groups and work with Representative Whalen on to see if there's an ability to change that in light of just the timing of having to get all of that information available for the tax statements and for the value notices that would need to be mailed out.
Thank you for that. Representative Whalen, comment or any other questions? Would anybody from the audience like to testify about this bill? Seeing none, then Representative Whalen, if you'd like to make concluding remarks.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hoffman, Representative Joachim, for your comments. As I'll just echo what Michael said and say we're happy to take a look at that and see what we can do. I think, interestingly enough, there is another due date for November 1st, so we would still be keeping it within a more or less consolidated form if we put it at November 1st. But if anyone wants to talk with me offline, I'd be happy to do that. With that, I thank the committee, and I thank Michael Stahlberger, other assessors, our nonpartisan staff for working with me on the bill, and ask for your support.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Whalen renews her motion to lay over House File 3277 as amended for possible inclusion. With that, Representative Erickson will chair, and I've got a couple of bills to present.
Welcome, Representative Hertas, to the testifying table. Representative Hertas moves House File 4134 for possible inclusion in a division report. Please present your bill, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I don't have any testifiers. I asked research and staff to draft this bill. When we listened to Representative Carlson, Representative Carlson presented a bill earlier this year about the situation where a property owner would go out of ag status for doing environmental protections and environmental erosion control by establishing some ponding. And while I was listening to that testimony, I was thinking about a number of constituents that I've heard from that have sugar bushes and are syruping and doing erosion control or pasturing, as well as other environmental things that are good for the environment, such as ponding, also deal with this issue of having acres subtracted from that qualification for ag status. Members, particularly in the collar districts around the surrounding metropolitan area, again, I often reference the effects of regional control by the Metropolitan Council. There are goals and policies that are coerced upon the cities to preserve assets such as old-growth forest and to have preservation of open spaces and things like that. And it got me to thinking about many of the circumstances that I've encountered, both as a past mayor and as a realtor, as a land developer, that there are a number of these properties that I think this bill would benefit and just kind of make it a little bit easier to keep properties in that status and basically not cut down forest and not destroy some of these assets just for the sake of qualifying for that ag. So it's rather simple. I was trying to address the parcels that qualify for ag but are not big farms. It basically says that up to 10% of a parcel not to exceed 3 acres could be used and applied towards that 10-acre minimum requirement to be classified as ag. So that's pretty much the crux of the bill and would yield any questions.
Are there questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify concerning this proposal, 4134? Hearing none, seeing none. Closing comments, Representative Hertas.
Well, thank you, members, and I think this just kind of makes the job a little bit easier and less contentious, and you don't have people coming into City Hall appealing their status because they've got part of the woods they want to save and not turn it under with the plow. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. With that, the chair lays over House File 4134 for possible inclusion in a division report. Representative Hertas moves House File 3937. for possible inclusion in a division report, and you have an amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The H3937A1 amendment basically is an oversight. When I asked the bill to be drafted and introduced as it was, I didn't catch the fact that it was my full intention to fully capture any shifting that might have occurred by increasing the exclusion from $100,000 to $200,000. So it was not my intent to cause a shift of the levy to other properties. So therefore, like we did last year, this is an incremental approach to weaning the state legislature off of the state general levy. And I basically, the amendment states as such that the levy is lowered from $784 million to $728.6 for taxes payable 2019, and the state general levy for seasonal recreational remains the same.
Representative Hertas moves the A1 amendment. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Please proceed in explaining 3937 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, I think I just explained the bill. It basically increases the exclusion of the commercial industrial properties, the amount from $100,000 to $200,000. Members, I'll just kind of recap where I've been for the last 5.5 years on the subject of CI levy. As you remember, this was a temporary tax to balance a budget, and it has become a regular source of revenue, which earlier today in the Tax Committee we heard, and also in the Property Tax Committee just yesterday, we heard about the effects of the state general levy on infrastructure improvements, what the cost was for utility customers for a pipeline, that it was costing them $15 a month for utilities to have that extended. Ultimately, members, the commercial industrial property tax ends up in the form of either higher prices to consumers or it ends up in lower wages to the businesses that work there. So the CI levy, there are about 122,000 commercial industrial properties around the state. And of that, you know, we've made some improvements here because it was approaching $1 billion, especially with the inflator on it just 2 years ago. And so we've made some progress. And in a time in which we are running surpluses and we've done pretty well as the economy is coming out of the Great Recession and it's growing and expanding, we certainly have filled the state coffers with regard to the budget reserve account is now at $1.6 billion. I would suggest to you that we're going to see a positive revenue forecast that will be better than previously predicted, and that this coming November there'll probably be another transfer of funds to that budget reserve. The cash account in which we maintain for short-term needs has got $350 million in it. We're not in a budget crisis situation. We've got almost $2 billion on the set aside, and we also have a budget surplus right now. So it makes sense to continue this slow, progressive, let's progressively eliminate this state general levy, and this will greatly make Minnesota's business climate much more competitive, and that's what we should want to be doing as a policy, getting rid of this fourth tier of property taxation. So with that, I yield for questions on the CI man here.
Members from questions. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hertas, you described the CI general levy as a temporary tax to balance the budget. And while neither of us served during that time, yeah, I have been repeatedly told that it was part of a major tax and education finance reform, and that the reason it was imposed because otherwise it would have given commercial industrial property a disproportionate reduction in tax burden, and that this was created to sort of have the tax benefits of that reform be somewhat equal to the different types of property, and that it was not in any way a balanced budget or let's throw some new money into the state treasury so much as it was about the ultimate tax burdens. And who was getting what percent of relief. And as you know from the debates we've had here, there's always a lively debate about who should get the biggest cuts and what's too big and what's too small and, you know, those sorts of things. And my understanding is it was within the context of that sort of discussion that it was felt that without adjusting this and with changing the school formula, that it would have disproportionately have benefited business properties as opposed to homestead and other types of properties, and that politically people made the choice to say, no, everybody should be kind of treated sort of alike. And I wasn't serving during that time, but I've heard that description several times, and so I don't know if there's anyone in our staff or elsewhere that could confirm that, well, but I just don't think it was designed as a temporary tax for a budget hole is my point.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler, my old alumni from San Luis Park High School, Representative Ron Abrams, was chair of the tax committee, I believe, at that time, now Judge Abrams. But while it's true that the CI levy relieves cabins from some of those educational efforts, it was my understanding that there was a budget issue at that time, and the decision was made to apply this fourth tier to balance the budget, and it was intended to be temporary in nature. The commercial properties are still paying for schools just like the rest of the properties. So this is a fourth additional burden. And in most cases for the small mom-and-pa shops, or whether it's even a, you know, on the floor during the debates in years past when we've had this discussion, my colleagues would often describe it as corporate skyscraper tax breaks. That's simply not true, because these property taxes for these big entities really flow through on triple net leases to the small tenants that occupy those spaces. Those are the small businesses. And whether it's a small strip mall out in Benson, Minnesota, that is owned by a conglomerate of investors, that still flows through the tenants that are in there, and that is mom-and-pa shops in large. 80%, to give you an idea, 80% of those 122,000 properties that I passed had identified, approximately 100,000 of them statewide are valued at about $500,000 or less. We're talking about small business here. And of that distribution, of that 100,000, about half of them are metro and about half of them are rural. And so to the Dilworth, Minnesotas and the smaller towns out in rural Minnesota, you know, without business, you don't have a downtown. And basically these dollars are being extracted and sent to St. Paul for redistribution. And we need to vitalize, you know, these small towns, as well as we need to really incentivize our business and climate, and to increase competition and make Minnesota a welcoming place to start or grow a business. So this one thing, if we can incrementally, it's not easy to get rid of it because we've become so dependent. You know, nearly $1 billion is just, it would wipe out any other efforts we do. But incrementally, I think we can get there, and this is a good way to do it.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I wish this incremental approach was done last year instead of freezing the general levy, because I did see runs that with exempting the first 200,000, we're actually helping 80 to 85% of the small Main Street businesses out there, versus the freeze we did on the general levy, almost half of those folks that are benefiting don't even live in the state. So I wish we would have done this last year instead of the freeze on the general levy. That's just my preference. But I'm glad you're also talking about making sure that we're getting money back out and into the smaller towns to revitalize. And I think that's, we got to remember that local government aid does that, and the local government aid comes from that, our general fund, which is replenished by this too. So when you do take money out of the general fund, there's other consequences as well. So just to keep that in mind.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you. Well, that percentage, as I understand it, is not half. 80% of those 122,000 properties are small value properties that are largely distributed half through greater Minnesota and half in the metro area. But again, I want to reemphasize, whether the ownership is local or not, it's really somewhat irrelevant, because the people who are really paying
those taxes are the triple net tenants that occupy those spaces. Those are the small businesses. So let's use the Mega Mall as an example. So the Garmazian brothers or whoever it is that owns it now, they've got this big building. And with the $100,000 exclusion, what that translates to is about $780. If we raise it to $200, that means it's about $1,560 or thereabouts. Let's just call it $1,500. And let's take it a step further. Let's just assume that there's about 100 tenants on each of those three floors, so that's $300. So $300 into $1,500 is $5 a piece is the relief they're getting, but they're still triple net leases. This is not a big corporate welfare program, and that's how it works. That's the real world in real estate, and the owners of the property cannot rent property for a long term and enter into leases when they don't know what the property taxes will be. So that's why they're always triple net. They always pay the common area elements. They pay the property taxes. They pay the maintenance. Those are all tenant costs, and that all translates into the cost of doing business, which comes back in higher prices.
I believe there are people in the audience who would like to testify to this proposal with concerns or with support. So please come forward. Ms. Padun? Mm-hmm. Welcome to the testifying table. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you. My name is Beth Padun. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm here to first thank Representative Hertas for his leadership on this issue, for bringing this bill forward, dealing with the high fixed cost of doing business in the state, which you've all heard many times regarding the state business property tax. We certainly support continuing to work on this and see how we can improve. As mentioned, and you've heard this testimony before, there's a great study that's done, a 50s state property tax comparison study that looks how Minnesota compares with other states. And as in recent years, the report just came out today, actually, and it still shows we're second highest for some types of commercial properties, eighth highest in the metro area, second highest in the rural areas. And I'm expecting that to change, hopefully, especially for the rural areas based on the bill that was passed last year. Hopefully we'll see those rankings improving, but there's still work to do. That's really a high fixed cost. It's a regressive tax. So it's important, we believe, to continue to work on that. I would mention, though, we do have concerns over the market value provision. We think it would just be much more straightforward and equitable just to reduce the overall state levy. As would happen when you do the market value exclusion, you provide, some substantial tax relief to those lower value properties, but those higher value properties will get much less. And we do know that there's many small and mid-sized businesses that are in tenants in those larger properties. And we think it's important and to make sure that they're getting relief as well. So with that, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. I see no questions. Is there a Mr. Max Hall who would like to come forward? Or others who would like to testify, please get in the queue so we can hear from you. Welcome, sir. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Max Hall, Legislative Representative with AFSCME Council 5. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on House File 3937. We have two main concerns, and obviously it's regarding the two major changes in the bill. The first is the raising of the exemption threshold from $100,000 to $200,000, and then lowering the amounts payable of the statewide business property tax, the commercial industrial tax. We testified in opposition to last year's changes, including establishing the $100,000 market exclusion, and so it's obvious that we would echo those similar concerns here today. It's brought up, the surplus has been brought up. So from our perspective and our 43,000 members who work for state and local units of government, really see our tax code in terms of the tax progressivity of certain tax policies like the statewide business property tax, the fourth tier income tax, the estate tax, and others, as really being pieces of tax policy of revenue generation that leads to surpluses like that and budget stability going into the future. So we just really see this as increased revenue coming out of the general fund, and you just have to simply note the revenue note that the department has put out. And so what it says is the reduction of general fund revenue of almost $31 million in net fiscal 19 and $108, almost $109 million in fiscal 2021. And in addition to the changes, I think it's important to highlight that the amounts payable in the CI tax is reduced in this bill by $56 million, which has not been highlighted to this point. So from our perspective, our members want to put more investments in public services as demand for public services increases dramatically. And so with that, Madam Chair, members, I will conclude.
Representative Barr, is this a question for Mr. Hall?
Yes, and I do have a question for Ms. Cadoon.
Yes, Ms. Cadoon, if you would return.
Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
And for this testifier, I'm sorry I missed your introduction, but you mentioned 43,000 members. I was wondering, could you tell me how many of them are commercial investment property owners?
Mr. Hall.
Given our members make approximately 40 to 45,000 a year, I would say probably zero or close to.
Representative Barr?
Sir, thank you, Madam Chair.
That was the only question for him.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Barr to Ms. Cadoon.
And this also might be Representative Hertaz also, but Representative Hertaz, you talked about, and in our bill summary it says that this exemption will not be shifted to other commercial industrial properties, and I sort of got the sense from Ms. Cadoon that there would be some shifts. So I just was wondering if we could just get a little clarity if there's going to be a shift in tax or not.
Representative Hertaz.
Thank you. Well, Representative Barr, every property receives the exclusion. The concern of the business community is as you incrementally increase the exclusion, you disenfranchise those taxpayers from continuing to fight for elimination of the rest of it if only the higher property values are the ones that are paying the levy. And I share that concern, but this has been an approach that has been supported by both sides of the aisle, and I know Representative Marquardt voted for this, I believe, last year, and understands the complexities of what it's like to keep business in Main Street, rural Minnesota.
Ms. Cadoon.
Yeah, I could just expand on our concern over the market value approach. You can have, for example, you could have two businesses doing the exact same thing. One is a tenant in a smaller valued property. The other is a tenant in a larger valued property. And under our current class rates, frankly, the lower valued property already has a tax break because they have a lower class rate. And now when we're doing the state levy and increasing that, we're making those tenants in those lower value properties have a much lower tax burden than the exact same small business in a multi-tenant larger property. And so that's where we see kind of you're getting a little more inequity in the system, and that's why we say a much more straightforward approach would be just to lower the overall state tax levy.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. We have another testifier, Mr. Kavanaugh. Please come forward and welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record correctly. I may not have said it correctly, and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Catnaugh. I'm a commercial real estate developer at Opus, and today I'm here speaking on behalf of NAOP, the National Association of Industrial and Office Properties. For starters, I want to echo the Ms. Cadoon's statement that we do applaud the amount of attention that commercial property taxes is getting, and we do want to take a moment to say, on behalf of all of our constituents, thank you for what you did in the last session. And that was a significant move for us to go to our contributors to say our voice does matter, so we do appreciate that. Coupled with that, and I know we've talked a little bit about it, but I'd maybe just take a 20-second diatribe about what is a commercial lease. One of the things that tenants and landlords look for is kind of that long-term agreement and partnership between a landlord and a tenant. And the tenant understands when they're going in that they're going to be paying their rent for using the space. They're going to be paying their operations for getting the grass cut or, in this instance, getting a lot of the snow removed in the middle of April. And then taxes. And that combination is their gross rent. And that's what it – and they're on their budget or on their balance sheet, that's what they're paying to run their business. And any opportunities that we can look at from a tax perspective – and I want to echo all of the statements that were said earlier – anything, it goes directly to those that are targeted to see the relief, and that gives them the ability to have, it hits their bottom line, and they can continue to reinvest in their business, reinvest in growth, and taking more space and employing more people. I think it's as simple as that. And when we work on a daily basis bringing businesses here to the great state of Minnesota, I think it's the same narrative that we hear repeatedly. We love the quality of life. We love the infrastructure. We love the dynamic economy and the very skilled workforce. But one of the things that does become a problem is for them to run their business when they start seeing what the cost is for taxes. And, you know, the cost of doing business is always going to be something that is going to be competed against, especially as we're looking to draw new businesses or to retain businesses here in the state of Minnesota. What we want to say is that we applaud the continued support to effectively reduce those taxes that are burdened on commercial and industrial properties. And our only commentary would be to be cautionary about the mechanism that we're doing it. I think, and again, this definitely predates my time being in commercial real estate, but I understand enough to say when the initial concept of how we were going to generate the general levy and continue on the automatic escalator, I think that was paid across the board by all commercial and industrial properties. And with the freezing of the levy, we think that's the freezing of the escalator, we think that's a great first step. And we applaud the efforts to continue to reduce the overall burden. However, we would just caution that doing it under a different set of rules than it was initially implemented is something that can unintentionally create some winners and some losers. And specifically speaking, you know, when you start to look at those that would be in a property tax valuation under the threshold, you would unintentionally, you know, encourage them not to invest in their asset and continue to invest because they would put themselves into a position where they'll now start being subjected to the general levy tax.
Are there questions for Mr. Kavanaugh? Thank you, sir. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, members. And I would just like to close with just kind of giving you a summary of what the typical profile of that property tax statement looks like, and I should have copied some of my own to share with you, but I'll talk about one vacant lot I have in the area that I represent. It's zone commercial, so it's a CI property. There's nothing on it. It doesn't demand any police or fire or snow plowing. Nobody's using it. The taxes payable 2016, when I was bringing this issue forward, were just shy of $15,000 on that piece of property. 37% of that bill was CI levy. So almost $5,000, or about $5,000, was CI levy. And this is a problem because even though that assessed value is such that it would be inclusive of the majority of small businesses, this is the type of burden that you see if you had a filling station in Morris, Minnesota that maybe was assessed at $500,000 of value. They too would be seeing about $15,000 of property tax, about $3,700 of that amount, or $4,000 is CI. That's money that should stay in that community. That might be a part-time job for a college student. This is just the main argument for reducing this and getting rid of it. But thank you for hearing everybody's testimony, and I look forward to your support. I know that the exclusion of all of the ways I agree with Ms. Cadoon, I'd rather just introduce a bill that reduces the levy, but it seems that I'm able to get more support by targeting the relief to those in a progressive way that most need it, and eventually, hopefully one day, maybe not too long from now, we can say this tax doesn't exist anymore. Thank you.
With that, the chair lays over 3937 as amended for possible inclusion in a division report. Members, tomorrow we meet at the regular time, 8:15 in this room. We're in room 10. That's our regular room. Room 10 tomorrow at 8:15. Is there any other business to come before this committee? With that, the meeting